Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 5th, 2004. Today's session number is SUK 2004-04. Today's speaker is Carla Zumala. And the lesson for today is, Here I Am, Lord, Responding to Call in Jewish Literature and Tradition, Samuel, A Call to Service. Let's listen in.
It sounds like we've had good news about the fire, so we'll go ahead and get started. Now, I'm very interested to see how this goes at 8:30 at night. Normally, I teach college students 18 to 22, and at 9 o'clock in the morning, I have to be, you know, going around doing a little bit of waking up here and there. But when I run review sessions, I often run them between 8 and 9:30 at night, or, you know, something like that. These same students that I see in the morning, they come at night, I don't even know who they are. These are not people I recognize. They're lively, they're engaged, they ask questions. I'm like, who are you? Why don't you come to my 9 o'clock class? So I'm wondering if that's the same here, you know. Exactly. So we'll see how that goes. Tonight what we're going to be taking a look at is Samuel. And as I noted yesterday with Moses, we've kind of turned the corner a little bit in our emphasis. We're looking at the issue of the self in all of this. All right. So I've got some readings and I've got some rabbinic material that will help us reflect on that. This whole idea of Hineni, the Hebrew, here I am. Right, we've looked at it this week so far with Abraham, we've looked at it with Jacob, we've looked at it with Moses, we're taking a look at Samuel tonight, and tomorrow morning we'll be concluding with this phrase in Isaiah, and kind of pulling the whole week together in terms of the characters that we've looked at. So far, as I said, we've emphasized the external aspects of Hineni, the stuff that you can see. Hineni translated as, I'm prepared. When God says, Abraham, and Abraham says, here I am, what does that mean? Abraham saying, I'm prepared, I'm willing, I'm available, I'm ready. Bottom line, I'm at your service. So it's really that active, external component to here I am. We're going to be looking more today and tomorrow at this internal part of it. Who am I? All right? And kind of what, you know, the other side of Hineni. Looking at the I in here I am. All right? There's tension in rabbinic literature about this I aspect between study and action. Between self and the other, between the individual and the community, what's the proper balance? Where do we kind of find the right place to be? You know, how much time do we put into study? How much action? Should it be a 50-50 balance? How much time do we spend focusing on ourselves and self-reflection? When does that need to turn into service to the other? All right. That's kind of a tricky sort of thing. I don't think only the rabbis had trouble with this. I think that this is kind of a continuing sort of issue in all communities of faith that struggle with these sorts of things. And so that's kind of our question. We're looking at that theme, summon out what we shall be, summon out what we shall do. How does that work itself out? We'll look to some of the rabbis' struggles with that tonight. For those of you who are first-timers, when I refer to the rabbis, I'm looking at Jewish tradition and literature, starting probably with the first century of our common era and moving up through about 1200 or so, and even a little bit beyond that tonight. We'll be looking at some of the Jewish tradition from Eastern and Central Europe, but basically coming out of that well of time. The question, you know, this whole issue, why are we asking, you know, here I am? What is the point of all this? And the struggle with balance. It's kind of interesting. Martin Buber, some of you might be familiar with Martin Buber, Jewish philosopher. He wrote I and thou, you know, that sort of text. He's got another text called The Way of Man, all right? I guess somebody needs to go back and kind of, the way of humans at this point. He says, begin with oneself, but do not end with oneself. Start from oneself, but do not aim at oneself. Comprehend oneself, but do not be preoccupied with oneself. How do we do that? You know, and where does that sort of thing come in? It's kind of an interesting story about how this plays itself out within the rabbinic tradition. There's Rabbi Chaim of Zantz, whose son was married to Rabbi Eliezer's daughter. So in other words, they became family. So Rabbi Chaim says to Rabbi Eliezer, now that we're related, you and I feel close to you and can tell you what is eating at my heart. Look, my hair and beard have grown white and I have not yet atoned. Rabbi Eliezer says, oh, my friend, you are thinking only of yourself. How about forgetting yourself and thinking of the world? Right? So how much self-reflection do we need? What's enough? Where's that balance? Martin Buber on self-reflection says, heart searching is decisive only if it leads to the way, presumably of God, for there is a sterile kind of heart searching which leads to nothing but self-torture, despair, and still deeper enmeshment. I come from some sober, melancholy fizz. I know about this self-torture and despair. Yeah, you kind of see that in some of my in my tradition, but and some of you can relate to people where that self-reflection does not necessarily lead to any sort of positive result or action, but just more self-despair. And Martin Buber says, no, that's not the kind we're looking for when we say, here I am, and try to examine the self, all right? There's another story in terms of this, how much should we focus on the self, how much and why do we need to do so? Here's another story told by Rabbi Hanok. There once was a man who was very stupid. These rabbis tell it like it is. When he got up in the morning, it was so hard for him to find his clothes that at night he almost hesitated to go to bed for thinking of the trouble he would have on waking. One evening, he finally made a great effort, took paper and pencil, and as he undressed, noted down exactly where he put everything he had on. The next morning, very well pleased with himself, he took the slip of paper in his hand and read, cap, there it is. Pants, there they are. Got into them. And so he went on until he was fully dressed. That's all very well, but now where am I myself? He asked in great consternation. Where in the world am I? He looked and looked, but it was a vain search. He could not find himself. And that is how it is with us, said the rabbi. So that need to look for self, and, you know, so there is that need. Without a sense of self, this fellow is called very stupid. So there is that need to know who we are and where we are and perhaps why we are, but not perhaps letting it go to that extreme of, you know, as Martin Buber says, the way that leads to self-torture and despair. The rabbis used to say, what is it that we need to know about the I in here I am? They say, consider three things. And remember, earlier in the week, I said they always have these things in twos, threes, or fours, partly as a mnemonic device. So this time, it's three things. I mentioned that there were four kinds of students before. Consider three things. Know where you are from. Know where you are going. And know to whom you will render accounts. Sounds pretty simple and straightforward.
Is there any connection between the here I am and the I am of God?
You know, I think that there is that possibility. We played with that in that Moses sense, a God who knows God's self. Encountering Moses, who says, God, who am I to do this thing that you sent out? So there is that sense of needing to know who one is as God does.
Is there any connection in the language
itself? Oh, definitely. The verb is very similar. There's a lot to be said about where God says, I am who I am. It's an interesting verb form that a lot of effort, time has been put into in Hebrew. But it does appear to have the very same sort of root in it. All right.
Might be helpful just to mention that that becomes the name of God.
Yeah, it becomes Yahweh. The name of Yahweh. All right, I am who I am. So as I mentioned yesterday, it is not an easy name to decipher. So we're not going to go through that. And there are a lot of different theories, and there's a lot of speculation surrounding that. But there is a definite connection between that. But I hadn't thought of it this way. A God who knows who God's self, you know, who knows God's self and wants the same from us. All right. And this saying is from the text that I mentioned earlier, Pirkei Avot. So kind of an interesting sense. What do we need to know about who we are? Know where you are from, where you are going, and know to whom you will render accounts. Now, I guess you could take this on a very literal level, all right, and do this geographically and put some names in there. I guess that's part of it. But I think the rabbis are pointing out a little bit more here in terms of who each of us is. Rabbi Zusia, shortly before his death, says, in the world to come, I shall not be asked, why were you not more like Moses? I shall be asked, why were you not more like Zusia?
Tell me about Zusia.
Zusia is just a rabbi who is well known for his wisdom. And so he just says, and what he's saying, God's not going to say, why weren't you more like this other, you know, great character? Why weren't you more like yourself, whom you were created to be?
Well, sure, I see it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you take a look at that. There's another saying, the wise Rabbi Bunim, in old age, when he had already grown blind, says, I would not want to change places with our father Abraham. What good would it do, God, if Abraham became blind like me, blind Bunim, and I became like Abraham? Rather than have this happen, I think I shall try to become a little more myself. Right. Now, what does this have to do with Samuel? If you've got a Bible or a sheet, take a look at 1 Samuel. Chapter 3, verse 1. We're looking at the first 10 verses. All right. First 10 verses. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his room. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called, Samuel, Samuel. And he said, Here I am. And ran to Eli and said, Here I am, for you called me. But Eli said, I did not call. Lie down again. So he went and lay down. The Lord called again, Samuel. Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, Here I am, for you called me. But he said, I did not call, my son. Lie down again. Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again, a third time, and he got up and went to Eli and said, Here I am, for you called me. Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, Go, lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood there, calling as before, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel said, Speak, for your servant is listening. This is the Hineni passage, Here I Am passage, extraordinaire, all right? It shows up more in this short passage than any place in the biblical text. Also interesting in this text is Samuel's very, very young. If you don't recall Samuel's story, he is the last judge of Israel before Israel had kings. He would eventually be replaced by the very first king of Israel named Saul, right? And then after that, David. He was dedicated to the service in the temple by his mother Hannah, who was not able to have children. And she went to the temple and she prayed. And at that point, the priest thought she was drunk and said, "Woman, what are you doing?" Because she was praying so hard. And she explained her situation. She went home. And she said at that point, "If I have a child, I will dedicate this child to the service of the Lord." She did have a child named Samuel and did dedicate him to the service of the Lord. So Samuel didn't have a whole lot of choice in terms of this, in terms of that initial phase of his calling. He's here in the temple with the older priest Eli under his tutelage and taking orders from him, and apparently his parents would come to visit him once a year on different festivals or pilgrimage times. So here we have young Samuel in the temple sleeping near the ark where the Holy of Holies is kept. It's, that's where a very sacred place in that whole setting. And it's kind of interesting, we've got a number of different sorts of "here I am." Right. Now, when Samuel comes to Eli, his use of "here I am" or "hineni" throughout this passage, he doesn't have a whole lot to offer in terms of that "I'm ready, I'm willing, I'm prepared." It's part of that. He hasn't accomplished a whole lot. We know very little about him. He's pretty young. All right. I think what's kind of implied here is that Samuel is saying, take whatever, I've got, the whole me, this external, this internal, use me as you see fit, all right? And he is beginning to gain a sense of self. It says Samuel did not yet know the voice of the Lord. So he's still learning these things, learning who he is, learning who God is, and figuring out what sort of relationship they might have. Now, I'm kind of interested here in taking a look at this. Why is Samuel confused? All right. What other reasons? I mentioned that maybe he hadn't heard the voice of the Lord. What other reasons? Why wouldn't he be sure where to go? Yep.
He was in the habit of serving Eli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. He was
That's
in the
what
habit.
He was there, kind of there for.
Exactly. That's, Eli was boss. Somebody calls, you go to him first. Eli was, and so in some ways, you kind of wonder, why isn't he kind of catching on here? But who else is there? This is his boss. He's been there for, it says, the text earlier said, from the time he was weaned. So this is even very much a parent figure, I think, for him. Definitely at that point. So who else would he go to? All right. This is kind of interesting. How does Samuel finally figure out how to respond? How does he finally figure out that God is calling him?
Eli tells him.
Could he have figured out who was calling? We've heard this reading in Vespers this week. Could he have figured out this call without Eli? Take Eli out of the picture. Could he have figured it out?
Probably not.
Yeah, who else would he have turned to? It says he hadn't heard. The word of the Lord hadn't been revealed to him yet. Where would he have figured this out? Yeah, you've got this priest, Eli, who's a key character in this whole thing. It doesn't look if Samuel had any other means of figuring it out. All right. But if Eli's that critical, why does it take Eli so long? He's the older, experienced priest. He's been in charge of the temple, or of this, sanctuary service.
He's asleep? And this kid keeps coming up. The kid keeps having a dream. Kids wake up in the middle of the night for no apparent reason. Who knows?
It's like, Daddy, I need a drink of water. Yeah. Not again.
Maybe he's very surprised that someone so young would be hearing the voice of God.
Yeah, in terms of what is this, and we don't know, does Samuel have a history of having nightmares in the middle of the night, needing another glass of milk? I don't know. Is that part of it? Other possibilities. Why isn't Eli cluing in? He is a man of God, we understand from the text. If anyone were to hear it.
He didn't hear it.
So what's the deal? What's their sleeping arrangements? Think about this. They're both, these aren't big sanctuaries. This would have been a relatively small place. This is, you know, likely much smaller than this room, perhaps divided into a couple of rooms with the Holy of Holies set aside, but we're not talking, and often the dividers between rooms are not walls, but curtains. Yeah, what kind of sleeping arrangement do we have to hear so that Eli wouldn't hear it, but Samuel would? I don't know, it says Samuel slept near, where? Take a look at your text, where is he sleeping?
In the temple.
Where the Ark of God was. Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the Ark of God was. All right? So it looks like in these times, God spoke through that.
Presuming that this was audible? I'm asking.
Yeah. We're presuming that it is.
Okay. Well, it says that Eli's eyesight was growing dim as he was aging. He probably wasn't hearing so well either.
are you catching a theme here about aging older men who can't see very well? I mean, they're in every story so far.
Did this prove that God is a female?
Yeah, I don't know.
The old man doesn't hear.
Exactly.
Or yeah. Right. And the visions weren't widespread, so maybe it was just too unusual.
Maybe Eli himself had had a long dry spell. Maybe nothing had been coming down to that temple for a while. Very possible. But it's kind of interesting that Samuel hears it, because I kept thinking about, why would Samuel hear it? But Eli hears it when Samuel goes to wake him up. All right? It doesn't look like Samuel's running in and shaking him. Here I am, he says. And Eli hears that, but he's not hearing that call. Yeah.
But why, we're assuming, as you say, that it's an audible, but it's a call to a specific person. Why would I hear somebody else's call?
Well, if I'm yelling out to, you know, what? Somebody, hey, Mom! You all are hearing that.
That's true, but if you're yelling out, hey, Mom, and I'm not your mom, I'm not going to pay any attention to it initially.
That's probably, and I think that's a question, this is a question the rabbis definitely played with. Why is it audible? Why would one hear, not the other? Why would it take Eli so long to figure this out? And we've kind of come up with some conjecture as to all of those points. This is precisely what we're engaging in, that searching out, seeking out what is to be found in that text and trying to make this a little bit more complicated than it seems on the surface level.
I feel a little better about the non-audible call because of what happens in this day and age.
The non-audible call.
The non-audible. It sounds a lot like a football game right now, but the audible call, the non-audible call. But I didn't mean to make it sound like that. I don't hear groups of people being called by God audibly at one time in modern day.
In some way, you know, at least what in God's voice per se, and in some of these stories we've seen that God speaks through other people. So, yeah, who's, you know, and that gets tricky. In this one it says it is the voice, or, you know, God spoke, but in some of the others it's not as clear how that works out. But let's go back to that. Why would you feel more comfortable with a call that was not audible?
I like the still small voice analogy, and I like the call to the heart.
Okay.
It's personal. Of course, it's a call to action. Mm-hmm. I'm not a theologian. I don't know what I'm talking about. I do feel more comfortable with that.
Right, you know, well, think about it. If you go out and you say, God spoke to me, and you go, you know, you wake up, and, you know, if I were to tell my spouse tomorrow morning, God told me. I heard it, actually. I think that he might have some concerns. He would check first for some, you know, heat exhaustion. You know, are you dehydrated? It's happened before. You know, some of those things, you try to look for some signs. But that gets to be a problem, Shauna.
It seems to me that Eli would have a sense right away of what's going on. I mean, given Eli's call that... Samuel's hearing something. You know, in a way, as his mentor, as somebody who has maybe received that call as well, could there be any reason why he's maybe not giving it away right away and just seeing, it's kind of like, I want my son to hear this on his own.
Or are we going to give Eli that much credit? Would there be a reason he wants to withhold it from Samuel?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'd like to point out that Eli's not in obedience at this point. If you look back to chapter 2, you will see that his house is not in order.
Right, and so whether that means Eli himself, but it points particularly to the behavior of his sons.
Right.
So it looks as if, along the way, Eli has not been following through on the way of God.
There could be symbolism in three times, because that's one of these numbers, that's a complete number.
Right.
And I think that could be part of it too.
Definitely. And it looks, because there are all kinds of different things. But the interesting thing, if you take a look at that, it actually comes four. Because he hears it the three times, and then he goes back for one final. But yeah, those first three that are parallel. And numbers play a big role in biblical texts. And rabbis love numbers, let me tell you. Just to give you a little breakdown on the Hebrew language, there are 22 letters. Each letter has a number attached to it, and they stand for a number. So when the rabbis look at biblical texts, there's actually kind of a game they play called gematria. They look at the biblical text and kind of look at words and see what kinds of numbers they add up to and play with this. If you've heard of the book, The Genesis Code, don't buy it. I wouldn't recommend it because it does similar sorts of things, but it's really a numbers game in some ways, and numbers in the ancient world and carried out through traditional faith systems have particular meanings. Seven is a number of completeness. Three, things are done in three, things like that, and they attach particular values to different numbers. So rabbis would have taken a look at this too, in terms of not only each word, but the numbers of times that he would have been called. So it's kind of an interesting thing to do. And in terms of taking tips from the rabbis in terms of biblical interpretation, that's one I think we can let go by the wayside. I think it's an interesting sort of thing. I don't know as a reliable sort of biblical interpretation. I guess if you run out of ways to interpret the Bible, that might be fun to pick up. But it's kind of an interesting sort of process that they had. They never used it exclusively, though. It was always in conjunction with other sorts of methods. So yeah, numbers are playing in here. But going back to that Eli issue. Oh, what were you saying?
I want to ask about the... Eli, as I understand, is the priest under which Samuel is the tutelage.
Right.
And maybe he had not been called by God or hadn't had this close
humanity experience
himself. How would he be feeling if before him this young apprentice type was...
It's kind of like, I have served God my entire life. He's still priest of the temple. He's still fulfilling certain parts of the duties, although, as we learn, his house does have some issues. He's still priest, though. Young whippersnapper comes in, and hears a call from God. He's only been there 3 years or whatever it is. I don't know that I'd take so kindly to that. What was he to hear God's voice? Look how many sacrifices I've offered. That there could be some jealousy issues there if he, like you're saying, if he does recognize it. Is he wanting Samuel to get this on his own? Or is there a possibility that he has a sense of the future? Because the news that Samuel eventually is going to give him is not good. Read a little past this. It does not bode well for Eli and his family. So maybe Eli has some forebodings about that.
However, it does say... can't remember where it was, but at some point it says, then Eli perceived the Lord. So it doesn't say it beforehand, but...
Right. But then it says, then he did.
That's right. But who knows when that is?
Who knows when that is? It's kind of like, what's going on in there? Maybe we could just chalk it up to grogginess. But maybe not. There are a lot of issues. It's a complicated text, because there are certainly reasons why he will not benefit from this call that Samuel receives. Mm-hmm.
Are we talking, he was talking about the internal call to the heart, and I know when you go through the process of ordination, they talk about the internal and the external call, and those have to be in concert in order for the church to put its blessing on your call to ministry. Mm-hmm. And it seems that this dialogue with Eli is sort of the tension between the internal and external. Samuel's hearing this voice, But it takes Eli to direct him to go back and listen to that voice. Eli is sort of that external voice saying, that's God's call, pay attention there.
So, and we need both, and again, kind of that whole external, internal part of that, here I am, the different components, there's always that balance. Yeah, it's definitely, we very much see that in many Christian traditions in terms of receiving call. When my husband and I were at seminary, we attended school, and I believe you were there too. There's a student from Syria. He was a monk in the Syriac Orthodox Church. He'd lived in a monastery from the age of 13, arrived in the south side of Chicago at the age of 35. All right, a little bit of a shock. All right, went from a monastery in the desert of Syria, and his name was Saadi. And in that Syriac Orthodox tradition, they did believe, in order to be ordained, they did need an audible call. And they needed to claim that in order to be ordained. Now, I'm going to blow David's cards here. David and his roommate were also roommates with this wonderful man named Saadi. They went up on top of the roof of the building in these ducts. Saadi, God is calling. Well, he figures it out. But there was a sense, there is a tradition out there still today in many churches of that audible call.
But for Lutherans, we take, 6 hours of psychological tests, and if it says, have you ever heard the voice of God, you better pass the test.
That's exactly it. That is exactly it. We have different senses on that today. What does that mean, audible, and I think we've kind of decided audible, but, not hearing voices sort of call.
So what is the right answer?
What is the right answer? I think we've got to go with the world we live in today. I really think, because I talked about yesterday when God says, what have you done in your world? How far have you gotten in your world? We're only responsible for the world we're living in today in terms of understanding how things work. And within our own traditions, it's kind of like those questions. Where have you come from? Where are you going? Where do we come from? Where are we now? Where are we going? And that is the context to which we are responsible. How do we receive calls in our context today? Is there an audible voice of God that we know of? Probably not. We're just, where are we hearing it? Through others. It seems to be that. Kind of that internal calling, something placed in terms of an interest, a passion that we have, and someone else in our community recognizing that and encouraging us. It seems to be that sort of thing. Can I rule out an audible call? As a rabbi would say, far be it from me. If God wants to talk, God can talk. However, I don't know that most of us experience God in that way. And if we do, we really don't want to advertise it that much. All right, and we want to check it out. Even if we do, you better check it out in community. Look at what Samuel does. He gets the audible call. He checks it out immediately with somebody else. You don't take it and run with it on sort of an independent basis. It requires that relationship and it requires community. So,
Just two things. Going back to the story that Carlos mentioned about Saadi from Assyrian Orthodox tradition, even within that tradition, the expectation is that you have an audible call, but it doesn't have to be necessarily while you're awake. Meaning, you can actually hear it in your dreams and in a vision. Mm-hmm. So there's a direct call that you experience, but there's also an understanding that that may not necessarily happen in the exact same way to everyone. Mm-hmm. And also thinking about the specific story of Samuel, one thing that, as we talk about it, I think about is, what Samuel ends up being told is fairly difficult. If Eli hadn't gotten involved at some point in kind of realizing this is happening, would Samuel have told him? Because what happens after he hears the message, which isn't very good, Eli says, you better tell me. And Eli knows this isn't good news, but he says, you have to tell me. So that somewhere along the way, it is important that others get involved so we have the courage to actually follow through on that call. He can't get away from it.
And you can see it on both ways. And Eli has to guide him to that call, and Eli has to get it out of him after it arrives. All right? So there's that definite negotiation factor in there, that this is no sort of independent thing on the part of Samuel.
What community does for him is it doesn't give him the opportunity not to respond to it.
Yeah. So he's got to go ahead with it. Another thing I'd like to take a look at this, and just in terms of the nature of God, let's think about God in this passage for a moment. How is God portrayed? What kind of God do you see in this passage?
Persistent.
Persistent. Persistent. Any other adjectives or ways of describing the God that we meet here? Patient, persistent.
Certainly not forgiving.
Not forgiving?
Certainly not of Eli.
Oh, not of Eli. You know, he's pretty. There is a strict justice element. What other sorts of things?
But willing to listen.
Willing to listen. All right. What else? What other kind of God do we have?
I picture it as a quiet, intense voice. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You know, it's soft, but there's a lot of power behind it.
So kind of a powerful, sort of quiet, you know, the silent, powerful type, I guess.
Well, and even in the fact that he hasn't spoken for a while.
Yeah, hasn't spoken for a while.
Shy. You know, uh-huh. Shy.
Almost like a physical presence because he said he stood there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes we miss out on that. Stood before Samuel.
Anthropomorphic or something like that.
Yes, very, that's exactly the term. Anthropomorphic, taking on the qualities of a human. And God stood before Samuel.
And that's right, when he was able to, he stood there, and then he had the words to say.
Exactly.
And he didn't have the words before.
So perhaps, I wonder, before that point, God wasn't, I don't know, standing there. So we have a God that is very present. You know, this is not a distant God in by any stretch of the imagination. What other kinds of ideas of God emerge for you from this portrayal?
Uh-huh. Well, I noticed that Eli had to tell Samuel what to say for God to go beyond just calling him.
Right.
In other words, God calls out, and he's waiting for a special response.
Exactly. And Samuel had been using part of that response with Eli. Eli kind of helps him to redirect that response in the direction that it needed to go. Take a look at that response. What does Eli tell Samuel to say, and what does Samuel say?
The word Lord is omitted.
Yeah, why is that? Take a look at it, because Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. He says, "You shall say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." Samuel says, finally, "Speak, for your servant is listening." The rabbis would have picked up on that, because it's not a long phrase, and all he had to do was get back to his bed. Okay, you know, this was moments later, and that's kind of an important word, God. You know, you don't kind of forget that one. Why would Samuel have left that out? Is it just overlooking that? What kind of significance, or perhaps lack of, do you see in that?
Well, he didn't believe it was the Lord speaking.
Dude, that's possible. You know, it's like Eli says, but it's the Lord.
But Carla, isn't it in that tradition blasphemy to use the word God, to speak to God?
Not yet. It becomes in later tradition. The point is to use the word or the name of God carefully. Don't use it inappropriately.
But that's this the is, point God is saying that Eli's sons use blasphemy.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. But Samuel, in that situation, Eli gives him some pretty specific instructions there.
He doesn't follow it.
He doesn't follow it.
But also, he uses his own judgment and determines that it's best not to speak to God
that way.
Familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yep, what were you saying?
I think he was afraid. He was afraid to recognize it was God, so he just responded.
Yeah, you know, kind of like, those are big words to throw around. You know, do you say that? Uh-huh.
Well, the first instance is it said, and the word of the Lord came there. Mm-hmm. And the last one it says, and the Lord came and stood there. So whether it was a physical being or actual presence, you know, there seems to be a greater dimension of the presence of God there.
Which, in that case, it seems as if it was, that clear, mm-hmm. He could have used speak, Lord. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering.
Is it possibly just a nuance of translation? In the Jerusalem Bible, I looked it up in before I came, it says, Eli says, speak Yahweh. He says to Samuel, if that happens again, say, speak Yahweh, your servant is listening. And then in that same translation, Samuel says, "Speak, Yahweh, your servant is listening."
You know, they've added it. They've added it. I've got the Hebrew. And it's kind of an interesting sort of thing where he says, where he talks about that. Before Samuel, in Hebrew it's not there. It says, "Speak, your servant is listening." That is interesting. Watch for that in translations. Yeah, why would a this is very interesting. Why would a translation add that? And that's a reputable translation. Why would it add that?
I assume that it was an error in the manuscript.
They're maybe assuming that, yeah.
It's maybe too difficult to imagine that maybe Samuel, even though it says the beginning of 3, Samuel is ministering to the Lord under Eli. To Samuel, Eli may have been Samuel's Lord at that point. And that's difficult to imagine for translation. But then what was so big about it is that that's huge for Samuel then to sort of back away from Eli being that and then moving to the Lord being his Lord. And the other thing is sometimes we do that. We have these mentors in our lives that call us to something, point us to something about ourselves, and we think, "Wow, you're so great." You know, where it is we want to be redirected as Eli is trying to redirect Samuel to the Lord.
I think that's very possible. The interesting thing is the word for God there are a couple different choices that Eli could have used. Eli could have used Adonai. Eli could have used Elohim. Eli chooses to use Yahweh. It's exactly the name God uses to introduce God's self. I am who I am. Yahweh. The most, perhaps, formal of the names. So it could have been some other sorts of things, but using Yahweh there, it clearly points to God, not other lords or masters. And maybe, as you're saying, maybe Samuel just wasn't cluing into that difference. But it's hard to say, though, because he could have used all kinds of different words, but he chose to use the name that God uses. So, a comment back here?
Just that previous verse about how he had not yet been revealed to him. This is truly an enlightenment.
Yeah, something had happened there. And reveal, the word in Hebrew, has a lot to do with light. All right? And kind of putting light on an issue. So this, not aware, but the language is kind of interesting there. I want to look at something else. We're going to be hopping a little bit here, but going back to the very beginning, where we find that Eli can barely see. All right? Think about who we've seen so far in these texts and the role of vision, of sight, and of seeing. Starting with Abraham, and if you have your pack, you can think about that. Talk to the person next to you. Where are words, in terms of being able to see, looking at something? It seems to me that there are some patterns here that show up in these "Here I Am" passages. Take a look with the people around you. Take a look at this passage. What role does vision have of seeing, of not seeing? All right. The first passage that we took a look at was Genesis 22. So if you have your Bible, that is one possibility. The second passage was Genesis 27 and Genesis 31. It has something to do with fear, right? Land of sea, to see. Oh, very possible there. Genesis 22 with Abraham, and there's a point in there where Abraham lifts up his eyes, he looks, and after this fade, and then Genesis 27, the next passage.
I don't know.
Any ideas so far about this whole idea of sight and vision and looking? Take a look at that, Genesis 22, all right? There, in the passage there. In that passage, Abraham has, in Genesis 22, Abraham looks up and sees the place where he's supposed to sacrifice. And you kind of have that, and this is after the here I am. So there's some sort of active component and being able to look beyond himself. He says, here I am. And then he's kind of looking off to what God is pointing to. So it's kind of like that, you know, I'm ready to go, now where am I going sort of thing, that visionary aspect. When we take a look at Genesis 27, isn't it interesting there with the Kineni, Isaac is surrounded. His eyes were dim. He could barely see, and there's that Kineni kind of enveloping him. So there's that here I am in that passage. I'm kind of working almost in an opposite way.
In the original call to Abraham, he's brought out to look at the sky.
Yeah, that's true. He's brought out in Genesis 12, and then again 15, there's that talking. God tells Abraham to come out, says, look at the stars in the sky. There's always that vision, and that's also with that call to Abraham to leave his land behind and go to a new land. There's always something concrete about this. And there's always something with vision dimming. Look at Eli and look at Isaac. What happens? It's an end of an era for both of them. It's almost as if that conclusion of their call. Kind of interesting. And if you take a look at Jacob, in his call in a dream, it's Genesis 31:11. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and he said, here I am. And he said, meaning the angel of the Lord, look up. Look up. And also we see in Jacob's dreams that he sees the angels ascending and descending. All right, there's that sense, look. Right after he says, here I am, there's the command to look. Kind of an interesting part there. In Genesis 46, when God speaks to Jacob in his old age, it doesn't say dreams. It says God spoke to him in visions. And these are all in Hebrew. It's very clear. It's the same root being used. There are visions. There's that sight component. God spoke to Jacob in visions of the night. Said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. You know, there's some sort of seeing part of it.
And it's to close your eyes at the end. So there's the foreshadowing of the
yes, and they use that. Your son Joseph will close your eyes. The conclusion, again, of Jacob's call. So we see it, you know, from the beginning, his eyes will be closed. Isaac's eyes were dimmed. Eli had grown blind. Kind of an interesting sort of thing. And look at where Samuel, finally in that call where he does get it, says God was standing before him. Presumably, he could see something. Yes, that whole idea, I think, is something to play with. That here I am, and then that look beyond. To look out, you know, and it's kind of an interesting thing that comes into play in each of these passages. I'd like us to do, we have a little bit more time. I'd like us, yesterday we did a tabloid, and we had some fabulous lines come up from Moses in the burning bush, all right? You know, isn't that remarkable? I just lucked out having, you know, the political circumstances to make that work. What I'd like you to do tonight, however, is we're going to look at this passage through different eyes. You know, I was thinking tonight at Vespers and throughout the week, there are kids here. It's not exactly like summer camp because kids are generally with their parents. But I was thinking back to times when I was a kid at camp and you write your letter home, you know, dear mom and dad. And I'm trying to figure out, now Samuel writes his letter home. All right, let's give Samuel an age. Let's say he's 11. All right, and he's spoken to God. He's been up in the night, and he's gonna have, you know, it's his, you know, monthly letter home. Dear mom and dad, how is Samuel gonna explain this? Think, you know, in terms of, you know, an 11-year-old boy. Think about this with the person or people around you. What kinds of things might be in this letter home? All right. So the post-Mark will be sanctuary at Shiloh. All right?
Mom, Dad, things are fine.
Mom, Dad, things are fine. Yeah, how do you explain this?
Yes, we're talking to Dave. Well, probably
he'll never
get to
say, tell him about other incidents. Everybody has things in the FPS.
Believe Samuel in this setting.
No, uh-huh. Well,
his mother dedicated him to the Lord.
That's right. His mother dedicated him to the Lord, but that whole meeting God, dedicating to the Lord, would not have been highly unusual in those days.
Oh, really?
No, dedicated. In fact, there is a commandment in the law, or in a legal code, that says you must dedicate your firstborn to the service of the Lord. All right, so that was a possibility, and family members may have been dedicated to service of the temple. In fact, in some religious communities, not Christian or Jewish today, there still is that practice. For example, in West Africa, dedicating your child to the service of the temple.
So what would the service of the temple involve? I mean, could that mean that he would just be a janitor there, or was it expected that he would be prophetic?
At that point, not as likely prophetic in the way we think of it, but he probably would have started out as a janitor. He would have been doing the sweeping. He would have been, you know, helping it with the animals for sacrifices. He would have been like the assistant to Eli. When Eli says, Samuel, need to get this knife sharpened, need to do it properly, he would have been doing that. Need to get these vessels, you know, so very much, in many ways, a technical position.
It wasn't an intern to be.
In some ways, it's possible, you know, in terms of it, he would eventually take on some role in that position. But yeah, the role of a priest in those days was pretty technical. It's not a priest that was preaching and doing confession, that sort of thing. This was a highly technical position. All right? And there were very specific skills that needed to go along with that. All right? But yeah, part of it would have been janitorial. There's upkeep. All right? And Eli was old and couldn't see, so who was going to be doing it? Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think that there's a huge parallel between the story of the birth of Jesus and the story of the birth of Samuel. You know, there's a mother doing a very similar song. If you look at chapter 2 and then the Magnificat, which is the song of Mary, they're very parallel songs in a lot of the way that they're written. But the content of the song of Hannah is so similar to the actual proclamation of what God ends up telling Samuel to say. You know, that the unfaithful will be punished, and, you know, that there's kind of like this reversal, the end of an era and the beginning of a new one. So I wonder, to what extent, you know, my image was of Samuel writing a letter home saying, Mom, you were right. You know, like, you know, on his way to camp, he's like, or whatever, you know, being sent to the temple, that all he's growing up, you know, when she's telling him what great plans God will have for him, he's like, oh, Mom, you know, but this time he realizes.
So is that possible that it finally, and in some ways though, he was given to the temple at the time he was weaned. In those days, that would have been maybe between 2 and 3. How much would he have understood? I mean, that's that you kind of have to take a look at. He went as a very small child. He would not have likely known very much. Latest 4. You know, saying, you know, great things are going to happen for you. But we tell a lot of 4-year-olds that. And, you know, that can mean a whole variety of things to a 4-year-old. Oh, goody, I get ice cream today. I mean, it's hard to know what a 4-year-old would have taken in about that. But that is definitely a possibility.
But wouldn't Eli have told him that?
You know, it's hard to know if Eli knew all of that. Because, you know, the deal with Eli was you dedicate your firstborn. How much conversation Hannah had with him and what Hannah actually knew is not entirely clear. It doesn't look like a conversation that would have likely been had. It says that she brought him to the temple when he was of age. So it's hard to know what Eli knows about this child. Because it doesn't make any suggestion that Samuel is a divine character or that there's some unusual spark there. He was a child, a promise child.
Question. Didn't Hannah go to the temple though when she was praying for a child? And didn't she encounter Eli then?
She did. That's exactly it. She's praying for, and so he says, you know, go home, woman. Your prayer will be answered. But she didn't. He didn't know what the prayer was about. So kind of an interesting framing at that point.
Wouldn't you be able to guess though? Wouldn't that be normally what a woman would pray for if she could child with some period of time?
Possibly.
I thought
she'd probably more than pretty likely. Or if he didn't know how old she was, if she had sons at war, there would have been all kinds of health of children. There are all kinds of probably concerns for family, because he probably assumed that she already had children. You know, that's one further theme I'd like to point out in bringing up this whole idea of Hannah. In each of these settings, we're dealing with dynamics where the woman was barren. Take a look at Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. Sarah was barren. Take a look at Jacob. His wife, Rebecca. Isaac and Rebecca. Rebecca was barren. You kind of have this continuing theme going through these passages. Samuel's mother, Hannah. So that whole idea of some sort of miraculous happening. God clearly working so that these children are born in each of these cases. So you kind of have multiple layers where God's working, where that, you know, all kinds of different things coming into play here. Well, I guess our time is up, but tomorrow I'd just like to let you know that we are going to be taking a look at this whole idea of what it means when we are ready to say, or when we say that, here I am, and look at it maybe a little bit more individually in a process to kind of think it through for yourself. Don't worry, we won't be doing any, you know, like sharing sort of thing, but I've got a little exercise for us. We can do sharing, but, you know, some of us are more private than others. More kind of, I've got a little thing. Well, you'll be working through the thing. I am what? I'm a sister. I'm an aunt. I'm a wife. I'm a teacher. I'm, you know, you kind of, and all of those things are part of that process of self-reflection when we are presenting ourselves. Parker Palmer, I'd like to end with a quote. Parker Palmer is a contemporary thinker who's done a lot of writing on vocation. There's a book in the bookstore called Let Your Life Speak. It's a small volume, and he talks a lot about this whole idea of call and how it works itself out. All right. He says, the human self also has a nature, limits as well as potentials. If you seek vocation without understanding the material you are working with, what you build with your life will be ungainly and may well put lives in peril, your own and some of those around you. Faking it in the service of high values is no virtue and has nothing to do with vocation. It is ignorant, sometimes arrogant. It is an ignorant, sometimes arrogant attempt to override one's nature, and it will always fail. I like the sense that where he says you must understand the material you're working with. All right, so when you say, here I am, an awareness of what that I is. And we'll be looking at that tomorrow and also looking at Isaiah. So have a good night. You guys did pretty well.